Hello and welcome to the We Are History podcast.
You forgot what it was called then for a second, didn't you, John?
I did. I'm getting on a bit. We Are History. Here we're here to talk about things that interest us, amuse us, share some historical facts with you, reading a book so you don't have to.
That's
what are we doing
idea.
Today, Angela?
Today we are doing the Suez Crisis.
This is something that's always been of great interest to me. I don't know why. I think I'm very interested in sort of British post-war politics, and this was a watershed moment.
Yep.
Did you know much about the Suez Crisis before this?
I sort of, in context of other things. So yes, right. I did sort of, reading about Prime Minister. Obviously, it was Anthony Eden. It was a big old moment for him, and. But I didn't know that as much detail as I do now. I've read some books.
Good. Well, we're talking about 1956. Try and imagine, if you can, a time when Britain had incompetent, arrogant, upper-class leadership.
I can't imagine what that would
it
be
It caused
like,
us enormous John. Damage with our friends and allies, damaged our international reputation, and all because of deluded ideas of grandeur from some old Etonians who imagined Britain was a world power and they were born to lead.
Could never happen today,
could
John,
never,
could it?
Could never. There's a little irony thing flashing on your iPad or whatever you listen to your podcasts on. This is sort of a familiar story throughout British history of, the subtitle of my history book was 2000 Years of Upper Class Idiots in Charge.
Yeah.
This was a classic moment when the arrogance and I'd say even the racism of the of the upper class to think, how dare the Egyptians be so uppity, caused Britain to do great damage to its reputation and for many people to die in a war that needn't have happened.
So where should we start with the background? Where are we talking about?
We're talking Egypt. So background on Egypt. So Tutankhamun was buried under a pyramid.
Yep.
I think we're probably going back too far there. Let's go, let's go skip a bit. So let's go back to 1869. When the Suez Canal was opened. De Lesseps was the famous builder of
French.
The canal, French guy.
And the idea of, so the Suez Canal is basically provides a route to from Europe to
the Indian Ocean,
yes. Without having to go all the way around Africa.
Exactly. So it's a long old way around. And for Britain, who's had ships going out to India all the time, this was
and Australia, of course.
And Australia a bit. Yeah, but it was the main trade route to India. And the British were rather peeved that the French had gone ahead and built this. And they sulked. They didn't turn up to the opening ceremony.
Ugh.
They thought it was a rubbish canal. Where are the narrow boats? Where's Timothy West and Prunella Scales?
Let's come to Birmingham, see proper canals.
Exactly. No, there's no shopping trolleys chucked in this canal. But soon after, having sulked about the opening, Disraeli bought 44% of the shares in the canal because it had been struggling financially. And suddenly Britain was a major shareholder of the Suez Canal. And the British Empire, it had always been Cecil Rhodes' ambition that the pink on the map should stretch from Cape to Cairo. Yeah. And British presence in Egypt was very significant. And we're sort of like a sort of colonial power in Egypt without sort of...
So we had loads of troops
there. And we were sort of the major military power in the region. So at the end of the First World War, Britain had the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. Britain had mandate in Palestine. So the two main regional powers were France and Britain in that area.
And the canal is operated by, it's the Universal Company of the Maritime Canal of Suez, right? So it's this company that owns it. Britain's got 44% shares. France has got shares.
Yeah.
So which gives them power across the whole of that region.
Yes. I mean, obviously, there was the Egyptians were not wild about this.
Yeah.
Thousands of Egyptians died in the building of the canal. It was Egyptian labor that had built this thing.
Yeah.
Tens of thousands of people died in the building of it. And it was not. It was something that they felt a certain patriotism about. And in 1936, the British withdrew their troops to just the canal zone, giving a certain amount of autonomy to the Egyptians. And the young foreign secretary who negotiated all this was Anthony Eden. And his face was put on an Egyptian stamp. They were so pleased with this handsome young debonair politician. He was on all the letters being posted in Egypt. And
really still making it clear that Egypt's under Britain's thumb.
Yeah, but the Egyptians liked Eden at this point. Little did he know that this little episode blow up in his face and would be the demise of his political career and would be the thing for which he would always be remembered.
So we're in 1936.
Yeah.
You've got the head of Egypt, if you like, is King Farouk, who has a nominated prime minister.
Yeah.
And I've just had a little example I found of how Egypt was still under Britain's thumb, is that despite this sort of nominal independence that was given to Egypt in the 20s, that in 1942, King Farouk's prime minister, Britain decided wasn't anti-German enough for them.
Right.
It was during the Second World War.
Right.
And wanted him to get rid of him. And King Farouk said, no, I'm not getting rid of him. He's a good prime minister, asserting his authority over the region. At which point the British ambassador in Egypt simply called up some armed support and wrote a letter of abdication for the king.
Okay.
Gave it to him, said, you're going to sign this. At which point the king went, oh, okay, I'll get rid of my prime minister.
Okay.
So really the Brits were still in charge, even though they'd nominally...
Yes. Yes,
sort and this handed independence to Egypt.
And this was the sense that the Suez Canal was ours. Even after Indian independence, after the Second World War, Britain's trade with India declined and that vital route to India became less important. But oil from the Middle East started to become more important.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Suez Canal was very important for that. That lifeline of oil coming to the West.
You can hear that noise. That is my dog drinking water.
Oh,
little Tina the cockapoo's here with us again.
So in 1952, there was a military coup in Egypt and the monarchy was overthrown. And Nasser, who was the big bogey figure as far as the West were concerned in this story.
That is Colonel Gamal Abdel Nasser, not NASA, the space agency.
Not NASA. That would have been weird. Yeah. What's his first name? Gamal Land or something?
It's Gamal Abdel Nasser.
Okay, Gamal. I'm just going to say Nasser. So he was an Arab nationalist and he wanted to see Egypt leading a united Arab nationalism against the old colonial powers and Israel, which, of course, had become a country in the 1940s. And there'd already been a war between the Israelis and the Arabs. So that was very much a powder keg, that part of the world, which it sort of remains, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So, you know, Eden had met Nasser and sort of talked down to him.
Because Eden, I think it's worth saying, Eden is sort of handsome.
Yeah.
Man. He was described as handsome but with a foul temper. Rab Butler, who was in the cabinet with him, described him as half mad baronet, half beautiful woman.
Oh, blimey, okay.
But he was sort of charismatic, yet Nasser, when he met him, felt he was patronising.
Oh, absolutely. He was very much sort of upper class English.
He Arabic.
Did, yes, he did. He studied the language.
Persian and Arabic at Oxford.
I think so, yes. And he was married to Churchill's niece.
Clarissa.
And
20
he...
years younger than him.
Oh, really?
Second marriage.
Okay. I can feel you bristling here, Angela. But,
well, no, I think it's interesting because Eden, his son died in World War II.
Right.
And that led to the collapse of his first marriage. And that's when he sort of became depressed. And from then, really, his health problems began.
By the time the crisis came round, he was
off his tits on amphetamines.
He was, which didn't help the whole situation. So, yes, he, as Foreign Secretary, met Nasser, patronised him enormously, talked down to him, not allowed Nasser any time to answer back. Nasser understood that, Egypt wasn't top of Britain's agenda. But Nasser said, I know I'm not very important and Egypt is not very important, but I was hurt. The Russians sent me copies of secret correspondence with Washington. When I asked why, they said it was Egypt is a very important country. I know it's only flattery, but at least they take the trouble to pretend to treat us as equals.
Yeah.
Nasser had patronised.
And humiliated, wasn't he? Didn't they turn up in, because Nasser and his entourage turned up in uniform and all of Eden's people were in civilian dress and they felt that was a humiliation that they hadn't been told to dress for dinner.
Oh, I see. No, yeah. They basically treated them like servants.
Sort
of what they thought of as the colonial, the colonies.
Nasser said he felt it made the British look like princes and the Egyptians like beggars.
Right. Manasseh was a proud man, a highly educated man, a very smart man. Mm-hmm. And he had big plans for Egypt. And he wanted to build the Aswan Dam on the Nile. And he wanted British funding to help fund this. When he was refused, he had the idea of nationalising the Suez Canal and paying compensation to the shareholders. Now, you would think nationalising something within your own country is, a reasonable...
Well, Iran had nationalised their oil fields in 1951.
Okay.
Which I think... it eventually led to the overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh a bit later by the CIA.
Okay.
Because they didn't like them nationalising their own.
But I mean, in Britain...
obviously, NASA had the idea from that.
Britain in 1945 had nationalised its own railways and nationalised its coal mines and its steel industry and its hospitals.
Yes, but it's Britain, John.
I know. So all Egypt was doing was what the British government had done, the Labour government had done the decade before. But this was seen as an outrageous power grab by the Western powers. The way that NASA did it, he gave a two-hour speech. And when the word de Lesseps, you know, the builder of the canal,
the
was mentioned, when that was mentioned, that was the cue for Egyptian soldiers to take control of the offices of the Suez Canal and all the key command posts. And he was able to announce there and then that he had taken the Suez Canal into Egyptian ownership, and the people were cheering him, and he was a national hero.
Is it worth looking at sort of what got him to that point? You mentioned the Aswan Dam,
yes,
which would have brought prosperity to Egypt,
yep,
right? Would have upped their the amount of power they had,
yeah,
would have therefore upped their agriculture and their standing in the... And the Americans and the British had both refused,
yes,
to fund it, which he was upset about. And
yeah,
then...
Or to lend him the money, I think it was.
Or to lend him the money, yeah, yeah. Which he assumed they would. And the reason that America... Because America was going to lend him the money, and the reason they didn't was because NASA said, "Well, I'll get I." Or one of
Russia.
NASA's ambassadors said,
yeah,
"Well, the Russians will give it to us if
yeah,
we don't."
Yeah, so it's all part of the Cold War,
and
really.
And so Dulles, the Secretary of State,
yeah,
in America, went, "Fine, we won't give it to you. Go
yes,
to the Russians then."
Yes.
You know? And
yeah, so John Foster Dulles was a sort of key player in all this. He was. They said that his most appropriately named sort of diplomat of all time. It was the verb went dull, duller, dullis. anyway, huge outrage in 1956 when NASA announced he was nationalizing the Suez Canal. It was described as a thumb on our windpipe. That's how Eden described it, as if the ability to shut off the oil that flowed to the West was like a thumb on our windpipe. Now, for the first time, people could say this war is all about oil. They say it's about national interest, but it was all about oil. And and Eden would go, "Yes, it is all about oil, and we need the oil, and it's Britain's oil, and it's Britain's canal, and you can't have it." When it first happened, there was a strong feeling in the summer that Britain would be right to intervene.
Yeah.
But there were those in the Conservative Party who thought that, you know, the British Empire should continue to be expanded and that Egypt should be a British colony. And he was dealing with his own sort of Brexity tendency, who were
Eden
the far right of the party.
Was,
you know,
quite racist against Arabs.
Oh, yes.
Wasn't he? And,
yeah,
and didn't he say at one point during this period that he wanted NASA murdered?
Oh, he became obsessed with NASA.
Yeah.
You have to set this in the backdrop of the generation who'd come through the 30s and 40s, and the overwhelming psychology of the politicians who survived the war was, we should have stopped Hitler earlier. We should not have let him invade the Rhineland. We should not have let him sort of Anschluss with Austria. By appeasing Hitler, we were, you know, you, as Churchill said, you feed a crocodile in the hope that it'll eat you last.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, all the papers went mad about the NASA Hitler analogy. It's Adolf Nasser, you know, swastika armbands on the cartoons, little moustache on, you know, the imagery is there,
yeah,
for a quick, easy cartoon. And never mind that NASA was just nationalising something in his own backyard, as Britain
and was
done.
More socialist than
absolutely
fascist.
Yeah, yeah. You know, imagine if Egypt had owned shares in the, you know, GNER or but nobody could make that sort of equivocation between Britain and Egypt because they are dark skinned and we were white skinned.
Yeah, therefore,
really was, yeah,
superior.
So, yeah, exactly. So it was seen as a huge slap in the face of national prestige of Britain and France, of course. But what the UK hadn't quite understood, and what NASA did understand, and this is really what the whole Suez Crisis is about, is it's a shaking down of who are global powers and,
yeah,
and who are not.
So Britain had been used to being,
yeah, for 200 years, Britain,
you know,
had been a global
power, global superpower. And then at the end of World War II, that started to diminish somewhat.
Absolutely. Britain had been one of the victors of the Second World War, still had had an empire,
mm-hmm,
still had many colonies. But NASA understood that Britain wasn't a superpower. America understood that Britain was no longer superpower. And this was the painful moment when Britain came to realize it itself.
And had to realize that America had superseded it.
Called all the shots.
As a superpower. Yeah.
And this, but I have to say, the handling of this could not have made it any worse. It was a series of cock-ups and arrogant miscalculations from start to finish. There are various other factors that may have made this disastrous sort of foreign policy adventure avoidable. There's a guy called Selwyn Lloyd who was made foreign secretary. He'd never been abroad in his life except in war, and he said he didn't like foreigners.
Ideal.
Perfect. Let's have him. So Eden told him, go to the Foreign Office. And he didn't even know where it was.
He didn't know where the Foreign Office was.
No, he didn't. He was driving around Whitehall. He had to stop and ask a policeman the way to the Foreign Office.
That's deliciously ironic. Secretary can't find the Foreign Office.
So they reckon that if Macmillan had stayed at the Foreign Office, a crisis might have been avoided.
Macmillan, by this point, Harold Macmillan, Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Chancellor of the Exchequer, future Prime Minister. And the person who emerged from this as the next Prime Minister. So he would be the one who took over. Maybe that's a spoiler, but there's a lot of thought that the advice he was giving Eden might have been deliberately bad because he wanted to see Eden out and himself.
Could you imagine somebody giving advice against their national what they interest. Genuinely believe in and national interest in order to serve their own political
imagine.
Ambitions?
I can't imagine who you were talking about. Now, bizarrely, the head of the CIA at this point was Miles Copeland, and that's Stuart's dad from the police.
From the police,
yes.
Yeah.
So Miles Copeland was very involved and had very close ties with NASA, and the Americans were watching this very carefully. John Foster Dulles and Miles Copeland were the key players on their side. The cabinet at this point had out of 18 in the cabinet, there were 9 Etonians, 16 of them from Oxbridge. And Selwyn Lloyd was looked down upon as a middle-class lawyer from Liverpool, as if it was a terrible thing to be. So between July and October, there was various diplomatic manoeuvres, but Eden was dead set on military action. It's a bit like Thatcher after the Falklands War. After that slap in the face, the only thing that was going to save his skin was a military victory. And he became sort of obsessed with NASA, paranoid about it. And as you say, he was addicted to amphetamines and he wasn't sleeping well and he was becoming more and more erratic.
So the Americans were really trying to push for a diplomatic resolution.
Absolutely.
Right? And there's a lovely story I found. Can I tell you this?
Yeah.
Because the British and French were reluctant. They were more bellicose. They wanted sort it out with military action. And Dulles, the Secretary of State in America, he came up with the idea of having an internationally governed cooperative of Suez Canal users.
Okay.
Right. So that would be implemented in order to harmonise the region. Now, his idea was to call it that. The cooperative of Suez Canal users was the idea he came up with. But the Dutch foreign minister pointed out that Kazu, as it would have been, made you think in Kazu Belli, which means the cause of war.
Okay.
So they rethought it. The Dutch foreign minister, he suggested Casco instead, but that was rejected because the Portuguese said it sounded like testicles in their language. So that was rejected. And the French also rejected it because it sounded like Casacool, which means arse breaker. So that was rejected. Then Selwyn Lloyd, the foreign minister who doesn't know where the Foreign Office is, he came up. He said, how about Askew? But that was apparently still rude in Portuguese and Spanish. So they finally settled on the Suez Canal Users Association, SCUA.
Okay.
So even in their trying, it was farcical. The whole thing was farcical.
So they settled on bollocks. It's bizarre that the time was spent negotiating all these things. But that was actually quite a constructive suggestion by John Foster Dulles. But no use because Britain, as they say, and France were set on military action.
And at this point, the appetite at home was for it, right?
Yes, although it diminished. You see, if he'd attacked in July, he might have had support. But as time went by and people saw the international reaction, the Labour Party shifted its position to saying that there should only be military action with the backing of the United Nations. And of course, you were never going to get that with China and Russia on the United Nations Security Council. So Labour cooled towards the idea of military action as the summer passed into autumn. And meanwhile, massive troop build-up were happening in Cyprus, which was a British colony nearby. Mm-hmm. Even though we had national service and 750,000 troops and 10% of Britain's GDP was spent on defence the British Army really wasn't set up for this sort of operation. Mm. The,
we're landing, not long post-war, are we?
We're still fighting the last war, really.
Yeah.
We had to get the tanks onto the ships, and there was no way of moving them around. They couldn't fit on trains. They couldn't drive them along the motorways because they just chew up the tarmac. So they had to call up Pickford Removals, who had specialist giant transporters, and move the tanks with Pickfords. They had to get Pickfords.
I'd like to move some tanks.
Yeah, that's the only way they could get it. So the troop build-up was happening. It became clear that Eden was dead set and the French were dead set on military action. The French were paranoid about Algeria, and that Nasser was an inspiration to the Algerians, Arab nationalists, and so they were dead set on action. It was clear that it was all going to kick off. Perhaps there we take a break.
Yes. We'll talk about what happened next.
What happened next?
Question of sport.
So we're going to have a short break to froth at the mouth about the decline of the British Empire. Stay tuned for the second half when troops will be a landing.
Does what's going on in the American election scare and bemuse you in equal measure?
Want to know what Biden and Trump are up to without tearing your hair out?
Then you need to listen to American Friction, the brand new podcast about the countdown to the big vote in November from the makers of Oh God, What Now?, The Bunker, and Paper Cuts.
Every Friday, we'll speak to leading experts and blockbuster commentators from the United States to explain the latest news and the big issues behind the vote.
That's American Friction with me, Jacob Jarvis.
Me, Chris Jones.
And me, Nikki McCann Ramirez.
Out every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, we're talking about the Suez Crisis.
Yes,
in
we are
history. 1956, Conservative Prime Minister Anthony Eden had been Prime Minister only for a year.
Not even a year, was it?
I don't know. It's 1955.
Oh, no, it was 55.
Churchill finally retired.
Yes, that's right.
And was sort of dragged off to the nursing home. And
kicking and screaming.
No, Eden had been waiting 20 years to be Prime Minister. He'd been second in command. He'd take the trouble to marry Churchill's niece to stay in favour. And everyone expected great things from Eden. And he had a snap.
And he was popular, right?
He had a snap election and won a huge majority. Mm-hmm. And looked like he would be in for a long time.
And then along comes
NASA.
Nationalizes the Suez Canal.
Presents Britain with a...
problem.
A massive problem, a sort of existential problem, actually, of post-war, post-colonial Britain. Mm. Are we a global power? Are we a colonial power? And Britain was about to find out that the answer was no. So the other thing I'd say to put this in context is that 1956 was an election year in America.
So Eisenhower
is up for re-election.
And he's sort of going on a sort of wants to be elected with peace in mind, right?
Exactly,
that's his election promises.
And the British, you know, image in America was one of a colonial power, and a colonial power that they had broken free from. So the American sort of foundation myth is thou shalt break free from the colonial oppressor. So for Britain to say, oi, colony, we're going to take that canal back, didn't play very well in the American papers.
I suppose the Americans, because it could have gone, I suppose they're worried about communism in the region.
Absolutely.
Infiltrating, but then they're weighing that up against their anti-colonial tendencies.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, I guess their anti-colonial tendencies won out.
In an election year, I think that's probably that's the playbook that Eisenhower had to stick to.
Yeah.
You can't go around backing military action from a colonial power in North Africa. So what Eden thought was, never mind. He was vaguely aware of all that, but he said, but if I present military action to the Americans as a fait accompli, then they'll just be obliged to support me.
Like they were in World War II, I suppose, but that a very different,
different
aggressor.
Yeah, yeah. And that was a fatal miscalculation. He's like, I'm going to go ahead and then they'll have to back me. And unfortunately, that's not how it played out for Eden.
No.
So the French are developing their own plan with Israel because Israel was prevented from using the canal and also was anxious about NASA acquiring Russian arms. They had this secret cunning plan. They say, I have a cunning plan, said the French.
And NASA had acquired Russian arms, right? With the Czechoslovakia Pact.
Yes,
he'd acquired a lot of Soviet arms. Yes. So he did have...
Oh, he did have connections with Russians.
Was it the Baghdad Pact? and the tripartite declaration, all that had happened, which meant that Britain and France and the US had agreed not to supply the region with arms, but Russia hadn't signed any of those pacts. And so he had unlimited resources.
Yes, I mean, basically, if Britain weren't going to help him, then he was going to turn to the East. And that's what happened. And it made everyone more paranoid in the Cold War and more convinced that this was the regional Hitler that had to be stopped. Mm. So the secret cunning plan that the French came up with, that Israel would invade the Sinai Peninsula and the UK and France would pretend to be shocked and go, you must both withdraw, both sides. And when they didn't, then Britain and France would invade as pretend peacekeepers. And this was all secretly stitched up at Sèvres. And, of course, the American intelligence completely aware.
What could possibly go wrong?
What could possibly go wrong?
So they had, so the British, French and Israel had this meeting at Sèvres where Eden apparently insisted nothing was written down.
And it was written down.
But it was written down.
And the American intelligence completely aware of the whole thing.
Yep. And although Eisenhower wasn't.
I think it became aware later.
Yeah, but at the time it wasn't.
No, but the key thing was that Eden did lie to Eisenhower during this period, and Eisenhower never forgave him for that, for an ally. There was a huge troop build-up on Cyprus and diplomatic games going on for months. Eden completely drugged up on amphetamines. And so they started by dropping special balloons were to be dropped on Egypt, urging them to overthrow Nasser.
These were balloons with leaflets in.
Thousands and thousands of leaflets were designed, and they would drop from 1,000 feet because they were so designed that they would, when the air pressure reached a certain point, they'd burst and scatter.
So the leaflets would spread
all over Egypt, and people would pick up these leaflets and read that they must overthrow. Unfortunately, they missed the design went wrong.
Right.
So these things popped at 6 feet off the ground. So just a massive pile of leaflets just probably killed one passing Egyptian.
Is it a bird? Is it a plane?
No, it's a British propaganda leaflets. So they adjusted the weight of them and they put sandbags in these massive balloons. And so they popped. So it came to it came to a pass where the British were actually dropping sand on the Sahara Desert.
Amazing. Amazing.
This was what was dreamed up in Whitehall. But at the end of October, Israel did invade Sinai.
What a shock and surprise for the British and French.
They were commanded by Ariel Sharon,
who later became Prime Minister.
Absolutely. And they easily overran the sort of deserty peninsula, of course. And Britain and France said, you must cease fire, it says here. Oh, hang on, giving away that I've been pre-planned this. there was a march against the war in London. And surprisingly high number, given the respect for the military so
by
soon
this
after the war.
Point, the British had turned, hadn't they? They'd completely changed their mind. They'd gone against military action.
The British people. I'd say most British people were still in favour of military action.
Oh, they were? Okay, fine.
But there was a significant march against it. You have to understand that 10 years after the war, or 11 years after the war, as it were, to criticise the British army was not something you did lightly.
I suppose so, yeah.
So to march against our troops was, you know, it was only 30,000 at Trafalgar Square, which, you know, is nothing these days.
Yeah.
But people were speaking out against it, so much so that Eden wanted the BBC put under government control, and he threatened to cut the overseas budget by 20% to try and force
the hand. So Eden felt that the BBC were being too neutral.
Yes.
Were showing both sides of the story.
Exactly. And they should
BBC
have
just balance. At least that's a thing that's gone away.
Yes. And Laura Koenigsberg was not
there. Concerns over that. Jesus.
Yes.
But I read somewhere that the BBC, that it's sort of BBC law, and no one knows whether it's true, that troops were actually stationed in a place off the Strand, ready to invade Bush House.
Really?
And that BBC engineers at the time were given sledgehammers.
Blimey.
So that if the troops did invade, they were to smash up all the equipment.
My God, this is that's amazing. That was in 1956.
That was in 1956.
Wow.
Yeah, at this time, because they felt Eden was going to try and bring the BBC under government control.
Wow, he'd sort of gone nuts.
Yeah,
that was the thing. And he'd only been prime minister a year. British warships bombed the shore. But the thing about the British at this point, they were so worried about international opinion that they were, or killing American civilians, that they were always fighting this war with one hand tied behind their back. So they bombed the shore, but told to use smaller shells to reduce the casualties. So this is sort of symptomatic of the whole way the exercise.
So this is Britain's peacekeeping.
Well, starting to try and sort of act against, you know, the failure of the Egyptians and the Israelis to withdraw from the canal zone. One Tory minister resigned. His name was Nutting. His son was bullied at Eton by a boy calling him a traitor, and he was pulled off by a young Jonathan Aitken.
Look at that.
And when Nutting grew up and Aitken was in trouble, Nutting represented him for free. That all dates back to the Suez Canal. Anyway, 1st of November, Britain destroyed the Egyptian Air Force on the ground, 200 planes. NASA retaliated by sinking 40 ships in the canal, making it unnavigable.
40 ships filled with concrete.
Wow, that's going to be hard to move, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I don't know how they'd get them back up again.
Yeah, but they did actually. But anyway, Britain bombers were instructed to turn back, though, from Cairo Airport in case there were US citizens there. And so when this all happened, Eisenhower got on the phone to Eden and said, I can only presume that you have gone out of your mind. So he wasn't holding back.
Eisenhower and Dulles were livid.
They were livid. So this was like...
He's trying to win an election.
He's trying to win. He's fighting on this. First of November, this is like 5 days before the election.
Yeah.
And a war is starting off in the Middle East, which Eisenhower is against and has expressed his opinion forcefully. And there's no, hello, Harold, how are you? Not Harold. Hello, Anthony, how are you? It was straight in. I can only presume you've gone out of your mind. And America, the UN, said with a heavy heart, it could not support Britain, its staunchest allies. And meanwhile, the Soviets were threatening to send troops to assist NASA. And this made obviously made Eisenhower worry that this could be the trigger for World War III.
Well, Russia threatened rocket attacks, didn't it, on London and Paris?
Yeah. Like, so this was a, you know, a real flashpoint in the Cold War.
Yeah.
So this unnecessary military action about a canal that we could have carried on using anyway suddenly was precipitating nuclear war with threatened attacks on Western capitals. So the Americans hit back with financial pressure, and the pound was falling, and the US was selling UK bonds, and Britain was refused help from the IMF. And the Chancellor, Harold Macmillan, he is thought to have exaggerated the threat to the British economy. And, you know, there's a theory that he wanted to see Eden humiliated so he could take
so
the top job.
So he did his bit in...
In saying that we cannot sustain, we cannot continue in this vein. The British economy is going to crash and burn because of the failure of the Americans to support us.
And in fact, there was... Because there were worries about fuel supplies, wasn't there?
Yeah,
there
so there was rationing was brought in.
Petrol rationing was brought in. So at home, people were feeling the effect of what was happening in Egypt at the time.
Absolutely.
Hello, I'm Dorian Linsky.
And I'm Ian Dunn.
We are the hosts of Origin Story, the podcast that unpacks the history behind the ideas, the people and the events that shape political discourse today.
And we are back for season 5.
We're kicking off with a two-parter on George Orwell, the man, the work, the ideas. We follow him from Burma to Spain through Second World War London to the writing of his masterpieces Animal Farm in 1984 and how their legacy is used and misused today.
That's Origin Story Season 5, coming now from anywhere you get your podcasts.
4th of November, 3 days after the destruction of the Egyptian Air Force, Russia sent tanks into Hungary, brutally repressing
so there was
the uprising
a student revolt
there.
that got big quickly.
Yeah, so that was like a brutal, you know, action by the Soviets. But Britain could hardly go, and even America could hardly go. Hey, Russia,
don't do that while we're doing this.
Yeah, exactly. So we almost gave permission to the Soviets to act outside of their borders because we were doing the same.
Yeah.
6th of November, British Marines stormed the beaches at Portside, the north end of the canal, and at the end of a difficult fighting day, the soldiers were confident of success and they reckon they could have secured the entire length of the canal zone when suddenly they got the order to cease fire. So they'd invaded, they'd secured the beachhead and they were all set to accomplish all their targets.
Yep.
And they're told, pull out, stop. And this was done because of Eden losing his nerve at the last moment. He didn't consult with the French. He didn't tell the Israelis. He just unilaterally pulled out. And the whole thing collapsed.
The soldiers must have been...
They were very cross.
We've risked life and limb. We're almost there and now you're withdrawing.
Exactly. So, you know, Eden had been drugged up and jittery throughout and he kept changing his mind and now he panicked. So Churchill said he would never have dared launch military action, but once begun, I would not have dared to stop. And no one could quite believe it, you know. The thing is, if you're going to be a bastard, be a complete bastard.
And finish the job.
Yeah, and I think that somebody said it with stronger language at that time, you know, with stronger swear words. but, you know, this isn't just a gung-ho adventure. There were deaths, you know, 21 British deaths, 10 French deaths. American report at the time put Egyptian deaths at around 1,000, and there may have been many more than that. So suddenly the whole thing had collapsed. Britain were pulling out. And Nasser is a national hero. Eisenhower was re-elected. The Hungarians were helpless. And overnight, Britain was utterly humiliated and discredited.
So Eden went from being
this sort of promising,
enigmatic, charismatic, promising
prime minister with a great majority. Overnight, he was utterly discredited. All other British and French holdings in Egypt were nationalised. And the canal reopened the following year. And you have to remember that Britain in the 1950s still had enormous international credit for standing alone against Hitler in 1940. Yeah. Britain had this sort of moral authority after the Second World War that France had collapsed, the Americans were not yet in the war, but Britain had decided to
Hitler stood up against Hitler.
And this gave Britain a moral authority that evaporated in 1956.
Yeah.
Eden pissed it up the wall, basically.
Yeah.
And
lied to the House of Commons.
Lied to the House of Commons, lied to Eisenhower. Pretended that
he didn't know because he
didn't
said
know
to
about the
Sèvres
plan.
Quote from what he said to the House of Commons. So this is the deal was made at Sèvres, as we know, with the Israelis and the French, and he said to the House of Commons, "I want to say this on the question of foreknowledge and say it quite bluntly to the House that there was no foreknowledge that Israel would attack Egypt. There was not."
Well, that's just a straightforward lie.
Straightforward lie, because the proof then came out.
Yeah, and it was issued and it was printed afterwards. Christmas Day, the Egyptians blew up the statue of de Lesseps at the entrance of the canal.
The guy who built it.
Yep. First attempt, it just made him lean a bit. And then they had to come back and
just looked a bit pissed.
Yeah, exactly. So they had to come back with some more and blow it up a bit more, and it fell face forwards and crashed into the ground. Eden took a holiday and he went for a break at Ian Fleming's house in Jamaica, the guy who wrote James Bond.
Wouldn't it be nice to live in the sort of world where you do the biggest fuck up, people die, and you get a Jamaican holiday.
Well, yeah, a holiday with the James Bond writer.
I mean, it's a different world, isn't it?
It was. The circles they moved in. Daily Mirror offered a holiday for two in Jamaica for anyone who could solve the Suez crisis. The new year, he resigned. It was put down to ill health, but widely believed he was forced out by senior cabinet ministers. And there's even a rumour that, or there was some suggestion that Eisenhower insisted that he could not work with Eden and that he must go.
Right.
Which suggests that, you know, the idea of an American president deciding who is the British
Prime Minister.
But this was a shocking readjustment for all these senior conservatives who still imagined Britain was this superpower that had won the Second World War. Harold Macmillan emerged from the so-called Magic Circle. It was called the Magic Circle.
Of the government.
Of the senior cabinet. Ministers of, who were consulted. You know, he beat Derren Brown and Paul Daniels. Because it was
you'll like it, not a lot.
Yeah, so there was no election of a Tory leader back then. It was just somebody went to the Queen and went, "You might invite Mr. Macmillan to come and be your Prime Minister." And that was how it was done back then. And I think it was the last one, actually. I think Macmillan was the last time that the Queen was advised by senior Conservatives who to pick. After that, I think Heath in 65 was elected by MPs. But yes, it was just a name recommended to the Queen. And so 1956 became the year of the angry young men, the John Osbournes and Keith Waterhouses, a sort of cultural rebellion that Britain was ruled by an out-of-touch elite. Yeah.
And of course, that carried on through, well, to the present day, but through to the 60s, you had Primo, all sorts of sudden sort of pushback against this political elite that had had it so good.
They had, but they won the subsequent election 3 years later, even though they'd completely been the architects of this cock-up. Even though this international disaster was caused by the Tories, they still won the subsequent election.
I feel like you're making some sort of
political point here.
I can't think what it is, John.
Well, I think there was a sense in 1956 that Labour had been insufficiently patriotic during the Suez crisis,
right,
and that damaged them 3 years later. It has to be said that if Britain had struck in July, maybe public opinion might have supported Eden. But by the end of October, it seemed like a fait accompli in the decision that he had made, irrespective of the evidence.
Presumably, if he had attacked in July, he still wouldn't have had Eisenhower's support.
No, I think, but what he did so badly was he launched an invasion, then double-crossed the British army, double-crossed his French allies, double-crossed the Americans. But to that point, I think Britain sort of came to its sense and realised it would never go to war about oil again. There would never again be a Middle Eastern adventure.
Never again be an illegal invasion.
Yeah.
Of a
foreign territory. So overall, the entire operation was a disaster from start to finish. It was based on false assumptions, based on racist imperialist attitudes, really. Dishonest, paranoid leadership, and all the goodwill that Britain had built up in 1940 evaporated in a moment. Britain was humiliated and reduced in power and prestige as a result of a appalling conservative leadership. Does that sound familiar, Angela?
I couldn't possibly say, John.
So that's Suez Crisis, is 1956.
And it's sort of the beginning of America as the superpower it is today.
Well, I'd say sort of the Second World War did that, really. But the realisation that it was not... I think at the end of the Second World War, it was like the big 2.5. You know, Britain was still sort of right in there with, you know, at Yalta and the post-war conferences. But after 56, there was no pretending that Britain was anything other than a sort of satellite state of the American alliance, and was not in any sense an equal partner.
Yeah,
and could not make its own decisions in foreign policy. You know, in terms of actions against Russia or in the Middle East. And that's sort of been the way ever since, really.
Yeah.
Anything else you were burning to say about the Suez in 1956 that you read or...
No, I think that's pretty much covered what I've read. I would say the books that I read were an excellent book called Blood and Sand by Alex von Tunzelmann.
Oh, yes.
And
she's very good.
It's quite a hefty tome, but the audiobook of it is available on Audible, and that I listened to that in the car. And
oh, that's a good way of doing it.
Very interesting.
I read Suez 1956 by Barry Turner, which is a good, hearty, and very thorough book. I think there's an episode of The Crown about the Suez Crisis.
There is indeed. Yeah. And there's also, I mean, I'm just going to mention Andrew Marr's book, History of Modern Britain, which is a good chapter on Suez, but it's also quite a good overview of
this whole period.
Sort of 20th century politics and what was going on.
Yeah. And the other thing to say is that, you know, the young men fighting this disastrous campaign were conscripted. They were not volunteers like the modern British Army. These were kids from
National Service,
which ended sort of a few years, about 5 years later, because I think it was the idea of serving the British Army was sort of rather discredited by this adventure. And so, you know, we live in a far less militaristic society ever since.
Thank God.
Thank God for that. Thank you for listening to
Thank you for
We
listening
Are History.
To, go on to iTunes or wherever you listen to us and rate us 5 stars, please. That would be nice.
If you could, and
tell
your friends.
Tell your friends, get them to subscribe. They don't even have to listen, just get them to press the subscribe button.
Tell them that if they can't get to sleep, then put on We Are History with Angela Barnes and John O'Farrell. They'll be out in no time. We'll catch you next time. Thank you very much for listening.